Welcome to the Commentary Magazine podcast. I am John Podhoretz, the editor of Commentary. Today is Monday, August 21st, 2017, the day of the big eclipse. Commentary Magazine, the 72-year-old monthly of intellectual probity, political analysis, and cultural criticism from a conservative perspective. Join us at commentarymagazine.com, where we give you a few free reads and then ask you to subscribe. $19.95 for a digital subscription, $29.95 for an all-access subscription, including our beautiful monthly magazine, in your mailbox 11 times a year. We just shipped out our September issue, replete with glories, one of the best issues we've ever published. Subscribe, you'll get it, you can read it online, and more to come. With me, as always, Abe Greenwald, our senior editor. Hi, Abe.
Hi, John.
And Noah Rothman, our associate editor. Hi, Noah.
Hi, John.
So let's see. We have the three Bs, right? We got Bannon, we got Barcelona, and we got Boston, as we decided. So Steve Bannon out as chief strategist of the White House. Horrific terrorist attack in Barcelona, followed up by a second terrorist attack in a beach resort about 60 miles away. And of course, in Boston, there was another alt-right Nazi rally that was basically overrun and swamped by protesters numbering about 20,000 times the number of the actual ralliers, and some Antifa violent left-wingers throwing bottles of urine at cops, and 27 arrests of same. None of these is connected except for the general atmosphere of planetary instability that they connote, that will be followed in a couple of hours from when I'm talking by the sun blotting out the moon blotting out the sun, which I assume will have no larger consequences, but it does seem to be a metaphor for the time that we're living through. So why don't we start with Bannon, since he has been a lingering preoccupation of everybody on the planet for 7.5 months. But I think it's increasingly coming to the point where people are acknowledging and realizing that his departure is probably essentially meaningless. Noah, where do you come out on the, in terms of policy, in terms of the good working order of the Trump White House, that the fish rots from the head, and that if there's a working order problem at the White House, it's not Bannon, it's Trump.
Yeah, I suppose I have a brief monologue in me on this one. The Bannon wing of the party is largely to blame for quite a bit of early Trump presidency's stumbles. We had just about every initiative that was embarrassing for the Trump administration emerged from this populist nationalist wing of the party, many of which were stopped in the courts. And I cite specifically the attempt at a travel ban that cited individuals who had visas to enter the United States, stopped in the courts. The effort to target sanctuary cities, kind of a broad Republican position that was consensus Republican position that was implemented sloppily and also stopped in the courts. Temporarily at the very least, but nevertheless something humiliating. The effort to use American steel to build a Keystone pipeline, which was always going to be a fantasy because there's nowhere near enough American-made steel to do such a project, but it sounded really good in the executive order, and that was subsequently rescinded. Bannon was always involved in these fights in the White House, but it didn't really seem like he was doing very well at winning them. And this culminated in a really bizarre interview with the American Prospect, in which he did what looked to me to be an effort to derail the president's strategy with dealing with North Korea. He said that the North Korean crisis is generally intractable. We are deterred. We will not be mounting any preventative strikes, taking that option off the table, while simultaneously telling this left-wing interviewer, with whom he'd never had a relationship but knew he was friendly to the interests of organized labor, that China is not really helping us in the North Korea situation, and that our diplomatic thaw with them in order to resolve this North Korea situation is a distraction from his grand Sino-American trade war that he hoped to reignite. So he was, quote-unquote, helping Donald Trump by really undermining everything the president had done.
So, Abe, what we have here is a grandiose vision of a new American political realignment that Bannon evoked as late as that American Prospect interview last week, Tuesday or Wednesday, right? And how he was going to redesign American politics along this new core. Okay. This is the same person who, under his aegis, Stephen Miller produced an illiterate and legally illiterate travel ban document that was destroyed by the court solely on the basis, they produced the document solely on the basis that because they believed that the 1952 National Security Act gave the president plenary powers over immigration, he could write and say anything and it would somehow supersede the First Amendment and, you know, all sorts of things. So the question here is, the grandiosity does not appear to ever have been matched by even minimal competence in the pursuit of these aims.
Yeah, you know what strikes me is you know, Bannon is often thought of, or had been often thought of, as a sort of the ideas guy, as a kind of inside the White House part of the effort to intellectualize Trumpism. And with all such efforts, the intellectual part is completely needless. Let's say you can do it. Let's say you can come up with this sort of high concept Trumpism, what it means in historical context, and link it back to older movements and whatnot. What's the point? Why you have Trumpism? It's already there. It's like if you go and you order a hamburger and you have a hamburger. You don't need the theory of the hamburger now.
Okay, so you have this totally accidental presidency. They didn't expect to win.
Right.
Trump didn't expect to win. He laid out all of these disparate ideas, right? We were going to pull out of Afghanistan. Iraq was a disaster. We were going to knock the hell out of ISIS. We were going to bring jobs back to the United States. We were going to launch a trade war against China. We were going to do this. He was going to make everybody's dreams come true. And then he gets elected, and of course there's no workable and he was going to spend a lot of infrastructure, and he was going to repeal and replace Obamacare, and then he gets elected, and he's thrown out all of these lines, many of which are contradictory, or they don't sort of add up to anything. And then the question was, what do you emphasize, and what do you not? And so in the end, as is classically the case with people who don't know what the hell they're doing, they sort of emphasized everything at the same time. So they did the travel ban just as they were supposed to repeal and replace Obamacare, just as they were supposed to do this with that and that the other thing. And so there was no sense of organization. There was no sense of command. There was no sense that they knew what on earth they were doing. And what you're left with is the grandiosity without any competency. And, you know, in the last podcast, I basically ended by ranting and raving and saying that Bannon was an idiot. Well, okay, so in all of these pieces on Friday and Saturday about Bannon's departure, he's saying, and people are saying, he's going to be so much more effective on the outside. I mean, really, he gets on the outside, then he'll have Breitbart, and then he'll really be wildly effective. Yeah, because being the senior strategist at the White House is worse than running a pissant website with like 12, you know, third-rate, you know, ideological morons, you know, laying out nonsense, hit piece nonsense. Like, it's not pleasant to get a nasty piece about you in Breitbart, because then you get a lot of email and people tweet at you and it's really nasty. And you know what the effect is? It has no effect. As the subject and object of several of these, it's of no meaning or consequence whatsoever. It does me no harm. Now, maybe they can do harm to Republican congressional candidates by fostering disapproval in their districts. And if they have a Tea Party candidate to their right, maybe Breitbart can give them aid and succor. And this is exactly the sort of thing that actual politicians get worried about, and with good reason. I mean, Breitbart did kind of champion Dave Brat, who ran against Eric Cantor and beat him in a primary, and thus, you know, knocked off the House.
It was a totally different environment.
Okay.
We have a counterexample in Alabama, where the Tea Party candidate, endorsed by the likes of Laura Ingraham, Sean Hannity, and Mark Levin, came in third place.
Right, although arguably to an even crazier lunatic than
But the crazier
than
the, lunatic did not have the architecture
not a crazy
of
lunatic.
Support. That's right. No, he's a Tea Party guy.
No, he's a Tea Party guy. And he also wasn't a
Tea Party architecture behind
him. And he also wasn't that favorably disposed toward Trump either.
No, that was the whole campaign was about who was more pro-Trump. But the Breitbart, what's going to happen with the Breitbart thing, which we're seeing already.
Let me just finish, just quickly finish the point, which is, you know, I wrote a blog post this weekend in which I said if Breitbart could be the equal of Picasso in genius, but Picasso went to art school for a lot of years before he became Picasso. Breitbart ran a website for 5 years and Bannon was the supposedly the co-chairman or like running the Trump campaign for 3 months before he was going to remake all of American politics. Well, American politics is a complicated business. You know, it's checks and balances, and it's structured, and there's, you know, 240 years of tradition, crusted tradition that makes it hard to turn the ship around and all of that. And if you don't know what the hell you're doing, all of your grandiose schemes are as nothing. It's like somebody saying, as I also said in this blog post, it's like Trump would never hire a project manager to build a hotel of his who had only made buildings out of Lego. Like, he knows if you make a building, you need to know how to order steel, how to, like, pay off a Teamster, how to discipline somebody who is, like, selling your copper, piping to some, chop shop for extra money, and how to make sure that the things run on time. Instead, so he gives the White House over to Bannon, who's never done anything. Reince Priebus, who had never even worked in politics, had worked at the RNC, knew nothing about the executive branch. And, you know, Jared and Ivanka, who the hell are they? And Kellyanne Conway, who was a consultant. So that's how you run a railroad. So Bannon is now out. Bannon can run Breitbart, and maybe he'll embarrass people, and maybe he won't. But this fantasy that you were going to change the nature of the American people's relationship to their government by assertion is what joins him to Trump. Trump thinks that words are actions, and he sees no difference between saying, I have made the economy the greatest thing ever, to actually having an economy that grows faster than 2.6%. As long as he says it, it's true, and he'll convince enough idiots that it's true because they don't pay any attention, and that's sufficient for him. And so in the end, they won't get anything done because they don't know that because they, you know, it's like hard work to get things, to make things happen. So that's the end of my rant about Breitbart and Bannon.
Yeah, what we saw today is just essentially that. It's, you know, the I'm helping by hurting thing. It's an effort to support Donald Trump by criticizing his pivot on Afghanistan, which we expect later today. From abandoning the prospect that we should just get out immediately, withdraw totally, and let contractors take over, to accusing H.R. McMaster of being behind the quote the many sides quote. This is them helping. They're helping sounds a lot like criticism, but they're helping by trying to force Donald Trump to get back to being the Donald Trump that they know and love, and that relationship is going to continue to be more and more antagonistic, insofar as this administration is run by military brass.
Well, I mean, one harsh attack on Jared that Trump doesn't like and somebody prints out for him, and then he tweets something negative about Breitbart, and we'll see how the
Have we ever seen Donald Trump go to the mattresses for Jared?
I'm saying something very profound here. If deeply profound, okay, if we go back to The Godfather, where we go at all times for our wisdom. You don't take sides against the family. You don't attack the family, and you don't do anything about the family. And if Bannon thinks that he has free rein to go open season on Trump's daughter and son-in-law, the parents of his grandchildren who speak Chinese, one tweet will level Breitbart. Won't level us. It won't level the Times, it won't level CNN, but could it level Breitbart? You bet it could level Breitbart.
Well,
if he says Breitbart is out of my favor.
Well, that's what I don't know. They seem to believe that they are, I mean, this was Bannon's MO. This was what kept him in the administration, holding a gun to the president's head, that saying he was the key to the base. Now he's going to have to exercise that threat that he was the link between Donald Trump and his artificial base. And it was entirely transactional, and now it's going to be transactional. I don't know if it's that simple.
I don't think Bannon would want to go after Jared by name, because I think he knows this. And I don't think he's looking to be at war with the president from the outside. I mean, I think his fantasy involves steering the presidency from the outside. I don't think he wants.
He wants that. He wants to take on the Fox News channel. The whole point is that he's a grandiose person who has yet to prove that he's anything more than third rate. And when he proves that he's more than third rate and is a really formidable person, as opposed to a guy who managed to talk a billionaire into giving him a lot of money, then we'll see whether he, you know, I mean, if I came to you running Commentary Magazine and this website and all that, and I have a column in the New York Post and I do this and I do that, and I was like, I'm going to remake American politics, you would go like, you're crazy. Now, granted, we have way less traffic than Breitbart, but, you know, Commentary's older and it's this and it's that. But, you know, you can have megalomaniacal fantasies no matter where you start. The question is, how many people buy into them? And Bannon in these exit interviews and his friends talking and all that sounds like a lunatic. I'm sorry. And I don't know him. I've never met him. Andrew was a friend of mine. But they were in LA, and I never met him, and I know very little about him, except what I read and what I've heard. And, you know, I'm still waiting, as Sean Connery said in his last movie, I'm still waiting to be impressed. I mean, websites that drive a lot of traffic, you know, there are these websites, they drove a lot of, The Blaze used to have 60 million hits a month, you know, or IJR Review had enormous traffic, and The Daily Caller has had enormous traffic and all. I fail to see that sites that have a lot of traffic, including Gawker and all that, have enormous amounts of cultural or political purchase, because they're worth, and we can say this ourselves, like we have a, you know, you can read some of what we have for free. If you sell something for free, it's worth what you pay for it. There's no deep personal engagement in a product that people stumble onto because they click to it from Facebook. I mean, its views can have purchase. It's the things that it propagandizes for can, like, get purchase, but it will not have purchase. Breitbart's fame, a lot of it is due to the left, not to the right. It's the effort to find an explanation to explain. Listen for a second. It's an effort to find an explanation for how these things happen. Well, it's got to be Breitbart. You know, it's the Kochs. The Kochs, they did it. They had a meeting and they spent all this money, and the Kochs are responsible for it. You know, you want to brand something as the great villain, and the branding of Breitbart by the left has been of immense value to Breitbart. But whether or not Breitbart itself has influence as a promoter of anything is very much an open question.
No, I think you're putting more value on the website than the personalities. Personalities have value and purchase. People like Steve Bannon as a personality because he has a radio show, just like they like Kurt Schilling, who's a Breitbart personality, who has a radio show. The personalities have purchase. The personalities will have long-lasting.
Bannon has no cultural purchase.
Among their readers and listeners?
Okay. Bannon has no cultural purchase. I simply disagree with that. Do you know what Bannon's voice sounds like?
The website, yes, I do. Actually.
Okay, you've listened to Bannon's radio show. Do you know what Bannon's voice sounds like, Abe?
No,
I've never listened to Bannon's radio show.
Okay, how do you know what Bannon's? Yeah, okay, so you heard him. You met him. Okay, but so you met him. Okay, but I am telling you as a pop culture maven, Bannon himself has cultural purchase as an object of contemplation. He did not give a lot of interviews. He was not on 60 Minutes. He was not on this. He was not on that. He was on 60 Minutes for 5 minutes. But I'm just saying, like, he is not famous except as a Trumpian thing, and his fame is now will entirely dependent on what he will do going forward. And if he thinks that because he has Mercer's money behind him, he's going to run the world, that is delusional. That's not the way it works. You know, he's talking about like starting a TV network or a news channel, like, get over yourself. You know, Rush Limbaugh has 20 million listeners a week. Like, when you get to an eighth as far as he does, and I don't know that Limbaugh has that much cultural purchase anymore for that matter.
So something I do think that will happen now is I think Breitbart will lurch yet further into real ugliness. Of the sort that happened before Trump actually got in the office, because now Bannon doesn't have to worry about his you know, they don't have to worry about Bannon being in the White House now,
right.
And Bannon loves the role of the dark guy. He's mm-hmm. the sort of force for evil. He likes that persona, and he's going to have to, you know, so he was being spoiler inside the administration. Now he's going to have to sort of act out. At Breitbart, so it's and that will make things ugly. I mean, it will sort of ramp up just generally.
The question is, at whom will the ugliness be aimed? That's what I'm saying. Right. If it's right. aimed at Republican congressional candidates, and he splits the party in a lot of these places and ousts, you know, incumbents who might have actual serious Democratic challengers, you could see the Breitbart effect being, unless he does this in places that are, you know, districts where Trump won by 20, Breitbart could contribute to the Democratic takeover of the House if he's not careful, if he plays that game. I mean, I don't know, you know, in some sense. Spin out the scenario, which is that you have a Republican candidate, conventional incumbent, and it's in a district that, you know, Trump won by 6 or 7, and a Tea Partier or a Trumpite runs against the Republican, and Bannon champions it, raises money for it, hits the Republican 10,000 times, and there is a credible Democratic challenger. So either this anti-incumbent Republican wins and is too extreme for the district, or the anti-incumbent Republican loses but softens and so trashes the incumbent Republican among the Republican base that some of the Republican base stays home and the Democrat squeaks through and wins. That's the scenario for the division.
Well, it's going to be an interesting sort of prolonged experiment in his thesis about these political and media battles. You know, he thinks that the more overtly obnoxious and transgressive and unapologetically offensive you are, the more your enemy is undone by it, more it sort of can't see past their own outrage and therefore trips over themselves.
Speaking of which, so I had dinner last night with an old friend, and we were discussing 2020 and the Democrats and Trump and all this. And as you know, I have been a sort of jokey advocate for a year and a half of the notion that Oprah has to be the candidate, right? Oprah has to be the candidate. She's got the money. She's got the TV presence. She's got this. She's a woman. She's black, so she can get women. She can get black people. And, you know, she's world famous, and he'll be scared of her because she has exactly the kind of fame that he respects and craves and fears. Okay. So then I took a turn, and I was thinking about the Biden thing, right? So thinking about Biden, granted, Biden will be 76 years old or 77 years old in 2000 if he runs against Trump. And then we're discussing how Democrats, what often happens in these situations is if there's kind of like a revolutionary candidate or something like that, the impulse in the counterpart will be to want to nominate his opposite number, not somebody like him, but somebody totally distinct and opposite from him in the sense that he's got experience and he's this and he's that, and you want to use him as an object lesson against. But think about Biden for a minute. Now, I think I am very harsh on Biden. I'm not a fan of Biden's. I think he's a ridiculous person in many ways, and I've been in various small rooms with him where he showed himself to be a total, you know, blabbermouth who couldn't stop talking, unlike me, where I'm obviously sharing the microphone time here so wonderfully with you two guys. But Biden versus Trump has an interesting quality because Trump's game, of course, is to be incredibly nasty, right? Well, we saw Biden with Paul Ryan in 2012. You think Biden can't get insanely nasty right back at Trump, and they're around the same age, and he will be like, don't you mouth off at me, you rich boy loser. You know, don't, you know, come at me like, you know, when you were out gallivanting with women who were not your wife, I was taking a train home every night to be with my kids when my wife was killed in a car accident. Because that's what you do when you're an actual person, not a homunculus like you, you creep, you know, like that. Like, how is Trump going to respond if he gets trumped by somebody else? And if it's one of these guys like George Hickenlooper, the Democratic governor of Colorado, who has such a great record and he's so good and he's serious, but he'll take it, you know, that's not going to work. You need somebody who is like going to drop an anvil on Trump's head like Trump does. And I think Biden is the only one who could do it if he's healthy, if he's got enough energy, if he, all of that.
Well, Trump will brand him as something Joe, I don't know what, yeah. And he will link him to Obama and,
right.
And all the, and you know, and he will yeah. repeat yeah. every yeah. complaint, every charge against
yeah,
the
well,
Obama
and then Biden will call him Vladimir. I mean, that's the right. whole point. Like, imagine Trump in 2015 at the first debate, right, when he starts yelling at Jeb, and Jeb turns on him and says, you know, I don't know. Jeb says, really? I mean, what about the mafioso? You know, how about the fact that the mob did thus and such? Or, you know, what have you ever done with your life except expose yourself on television? You know, like, they all were so shocked and appalled, and they were like, they didn't know what to do, and they were like, I'm not going to grace this with a response. So all of that, so they got their lunch eaten by a guy who had no manners and no propriety and all of that. And that's who Biden was in 2012 to Ryan. He just like mocked Ryan for a solid hour and a half in that vice presidential debate and took Ryan down.
Actually, you know, it's an interesting point because the last election, Trump was the only one who was so wildly transgressive of the norms and the
yeah.
rules. Well, now, when it's 4 years later, there's no mistaking what the rules yeah. are and what the new game is. No one's right. going to be shy.
And
that
Democrats
way.
Are going to want. They think that Bernie maybe could do it or Elizabeth Warren could do it, but they can't do it.
Right.
They can't do it. I mean, you know, Biden stands there and says, "Look, I was a vice president for 8 years. Everybody." I mean, Biden can do the miss me yet thing, by the way. You're saying he'll be tied to Obama. You think that's going to be bad in 2020? It's hard to say. It's hard to
yeah,
say.
I don't know.
That wasn't what got Trump over Hillary.
Right.
Hillary was herself the object because of the emails and because of the crookedness and because of Bill and the women and all of that. It wasn't Obama. Trump stayed away from Obama. He didn't like Obamacare. He didn't attack Obama.
While we're waxing fantastical about 2020.
Why not? It's all anybody cares about.
We have two Republican senators today who will not go on record endorsing his nomination.
Susan Collins.
And Bob Corker, who's just sort of passing on the conversation. We had a conversation in this office on Thursday in the wake of Donald Trump putting out yet another tweet about how an apocryphal story about how an American general, General Pershing, was responsible for war crimes against Muslims. And that was his response to the ongoing violence in Barcelona. And we said, how can this go on? How can this continue for another 3.5 years? How can we sustain ourselves in this outrage? How can Republicans go on record every other day defending this guy while their agenda collapses out from under
them? How long can Democrats go, how long is the fight going to be? When are Republicans going to attack Trump? When are Republicans going to turn away from Trump? When are this? When is the outrage going to express itself? I mean, even the outrage about the lack of outrage has a burnout effect, right? I mean, that's where we go with the...
I think we've reached the burnout effect for people who are predisposed to support Donald Trump.
Right.
Period. And I think that's where we're going to get. I don't think the outrage effect will ever cease for people. As long as we keep pushing the envelope like we've been pushing it, people who are honestly not engaged with this presidency, have not invested and sunk costs into this presidency, will continue to be outraged.
Okay. So we should go on and discuss this after a brief intermission to discuss our friends at The Great Courses Plus. Because as you know, Abe, because you are our Great Courses Plus champion, our viewer, our testifier, with so many historical moments happening right now, it's important to know the details of how we got here. And one way we at Commentary are doing that is by watching The Great Courses Plus. We find it so satisfying to learn from these trusted, engaging experts. It's like getting to sit in on the most fascinating university courses for our own enjoyment, all on our own schedules, and there's unlimited access to thousands of fascinating video lectures from politics, economics, even photography or cooking. And man, could I use one on cooking right now, because I tried to make sugar cookies this weekend and it was a disaster, and I was using an incredibly simple recipe and they came out like garbage. So maybe I need a Great Courses Plus on cooking. We recommend watching Turning Points in Modern History. And Abe, as a viewer of the Turning Points in Modern History course, this unique perspective on world history from the discoveries, inventions, and ideas that have shaped the world, what have you learned, Abe Greenwald?
Well, the second lecture was about the fall of Constantinople in 1453. Among the many very serious things I learned is the fact that an eclipse also heralded that event. It was a lunar eclipse, but I was surprised to learn that. No, it's a fascinating turning point in history, and it was the sort of official 1,000 year after the fact final nail in the coffin of Rome. And
Rome is a dominating political,
right? Yes,
military force,
right,
on the,
right,
continent,
and also as an idea too, right, because it left a sort of not only an actual power vacuum, but this sort of competition for who would inherit this, who would be next in the line of succession of empire,
right?
And that's a sort of race that you can even see in elements of things like Russian foreign policy up to this day.
Right. Because Constantinople fell, of course, to the
Turks.
Muslims.
Yeah,
yeah,
right.
To the Turks.
Right.
And that made Moscow the Third Rome.
That's right. Right. And Moscow had aspired to actually go back after Constantinople on a number of occasions, but particularly under Catherine.
Well, it's one of the striking things if you go there, if you go to Istanbul now, and you visit Hagia Sophia, which is one of the great buildings of the world, this mosque that is the sort of, it's, you know, it's like the Colosseum. It's like the dominating building in the city. And it was a church. It was a church. And when Constantinople fell, it became the greatest piece of, it's the symbol of the takeover of Rome by,
right,
by Islam, or this great church, the greatest church built in the world next to Notre Dame and the Vatican, and is now a mosque. So that is fascinating, and you can watch that and thousands of other courses by streaming The Great Courses Plus from your smartphone, tablet, laptop, TV, or download the videos to watch offline, great for traveling. We want you to check out The Great Courses Plus today. You'll love it. They're offering our listeners a full month of free video lectures when you sign up using our special URL, thegreatcoursesplus.com/commentary. Start your free month now. Sign up at thegreatcoursesplus.com/commentary. It's all one word, thegreatcoursesplus.com/commentary. And we thank them for sponsoring the Commentary podcast. So, Noah, we can't go on, and whether or not the Trump forces, the forces arrayed as supporters of Trump have reached the point at which they are no longer reachable, let's say, to give up on this guy, right? To say that's what you're saying. Like we've hit the moment at which there's a law of diminishing returns. If they're not going to turn because of last week, they're not going to turn, right?
Yeah.
Okay, what you're saying?
Correct.
Okay. Okay, so what we have then is the simple fact of the matter that there is a political war going on in the United States. And so Trump summons trouble on himself, right? Because he says from all sides, and he does this, and he doesn't denounce Nazis enough, and he separates Nazis from the alt-right, and everything that we criticized last week. And tens of millions of Republican voters watch this and they say, it's all nonsense. It's all they're just trying to get him. They're trying to get him however they can get him. He said he didn't like violence on all sides. What's wrong with saying that on many sides? What's wrong with that? And I'm not giving in. You know what? You can say
that's
anything.
That's too honest.
I'm saying tens of millions of people.
They wouldn't be that honest with themselves. They would find an actual legitimate.
Well, they said, like he said, he was against violence on many sides, and right. I see, like they have Antifa, and they have someone's throwing urine bottles at Boston policemen, and blah blah blah. Okay, but all I'm saying is that so let's say they're not that honest.
They wouldn't admit to themselves that this is a rationalization.
Well, I'm not even sure it is a rationalization. So, because it is, liberals are ganging up on Trump in an effort to get him out, and we're not going to contribute to this effort. He's fine with us. He's fighting for issues that we believe in. They're all a bunch of commies who are trying to undermine this country, or you know, and undermine the efforts to make the country great again, and we are not giving in to them. They can say anything they want, and they can go to hell.
Yeah, I've got to say, even before Charlottesville, I've had discussions with Trump supporters who said to me something that I've never heard any other supporters of any other politician or candidate ever say, which is, I don't care what he said. I don't care what he did. I support him, okay? It doesn't matter. I support him. Because their support is absolutely disconnected from what he does or says.
And why is that? Because of his enemies.
Right.
I mean, I think that Ross Douthat had a brilliant column last week in which he pointed something out that I've never seen kind of crystallized in this way, which is we have this insane division in the United States, right? Republicans control the commanding heights of politics. Presidency, Congress, the Senate, 34 governorships, 70 out of 100 state legislatures, 1,000 seats won at the state and local level since Obama took the presidency. Political domination of a sort we haven't seen by one party since the 1920s, right? Or by the Republican Party since the 1920s. And on the other hand, liberals have total control of the culture, the universities, the education system, television, the movies, you know, everything that counts as culture is monolithically liberal. And one has a hardening impact on the other. It is the liberal domination of culture that helps provide the conservative domination of politics and vice versa. So there's a piece in the New York
Times. And they both feel equally threatened by one another.
Right.
I think he said
they both feel like they're under siege.
Right. But they're both under enemy rule, I think, is what he said. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So if you think about that, and then you think like, okay, well, surely there can be an accommodation. Well, there can't be an accommodation, right? Because what television network is going to put on, you know, what movie studio is going to make movies that reflect the Trump worldview? What movie studio is going to remake the Ron Howard movie Gung Ho about how, you know, American factory shows that it can make goods better than the Japanese or whatever. I don't know. I'm trying to sort of think of what would count, you know, as a sort of Trumpian cultural product. Even though it could make a lot of money, even though it could be this, even though it could be that, even though American Sniper showed if you get it right, you can make $700 million off a $30 million budget. They don't want to make it. To them, that would be poison. That would destroy everything that they want to be, right? So even though all they want to do is make money and it's all okay. So, and in political terms, John Ossoff coming into Georgia to try to win that seat guarantees the Republicans win the seat because they're not going to give this physical object lesson to an Obama person, right? This kind of like skinny 30-year-old wise ass Jewish kid, you know, carpetbagger. They're not going to give him the time of day. He almost won, but I mean, you know what I'm saying? Like the fact that it's him and not, you know, some good old boy in a pickup truck. Well, that's not really the district, but you take my point. Like, you know, it's not really him, and he didn't really live in the district. And they're not going to get. They are still, in the end, against liberal cultural values, which are about, you know, overcoming American jingoism and whatever, however you want to lay it out. And so there's no answer to this. There's no getting out of this cycle. That would be the...
Right. Well, that was the... I mean, I think the sort of...
That's, I think, what they mean when they say, I support him, I don't care what he says. Because they're not supporting him. They're supporting his representation of the fact that they are not going to let the country get taken over by those people.
Right, right. It's a...
And it was taken over by those people, and they had it for 2 years, and what did they do? They spent $2.5 trillion, and they passed Obamacare, and they passed TARP 2, and they passed Dodd-Frank, and they nationalized the auto industries, and this is the great desideratum of liberals, and this is exactly what people who are nominally, broadly considered conservatives hate
but
and despise.
What you're describing is remarkably shallow support. It seems unassailable with, you know, a really deep foundation, but it has nothing to do with the man. It's entirely transactional. The minute he stops representing these things or appears failed in representing these things is the minute the support looks like it's reached the point of diminishing returns. And we have Republicans who are going to be forced every day for now in the next 3 years, presuming they retain their political potency, to contemplate impeachment. Every day. It's never going to stop. So every day this faith is going to have to be reaffirmed. Uh-huh. And these supporters are going to have to be satisfied that their support is being, you know, relevant and they're getting a return on their investment. And we're going to go through this every week.
Maybe
for another
it's not
50
shallow
weeks.
At all. But maybe it's not shallow at all. Maybe this is the deepest kind of support. Maybe the idea that he is all that stands between us and total self and total destruction is very strong and very potent.
I can't imagine we're talking about anything beyond a very tiny sliver of Donald Trump's base of support, which is itself a tiny sliver of the American electorate.
I don't think so, because I've spoken to people that you might, I mean, it's purely anecdotal, but I've spoken to sort of New York Trump supporters who have said things along these lines. I mean the scary thing is, how do these people come back into the fold of sort of regular good faith politics after this? At what point do you stop saying, I don't care what he says or does, I just want to move away from the other side? That's an emotional pull. I mean, there was always this line, right, that conservatives think that liberals are wrong and liberals think conservatives are evil. We're talking about conservatives who now think liberals are evil, and that's the sort of motivation. And it's hard to corral people on both sides of that back into sort of discussing policy and plain old people being wrong as opposed to being evil.
I mean, we are through the looking glass. We're not going back. There's not going to be a restoration of some kind of common order here. And something new is being built around us that we can't even begin entirely to visualize. That is a system in which the root feeling of the American voter or the root feeling of the most passionate American voter, let's say, is distrust, right? So the root Democratic, the Sanders voter, right? Sanders got 45% of the vote in the Democratic Party, and the Trump voter, Trump got 45% of the Republican Party. Their root feeling is distrust and mistrust of democratic institutions, of politicians, of mediating institutions, and all of that. How is that trust going to be rebuilt? That's two separate parts of America. That's a great many people. That's tens and tens of, that's 70, 80 million people who have left the precincts in which they believe that, all things being equal, Americans lead a decent life in part because, or can lead a decent life in part because, we have built institutions and we have a political system that, compared to others, gives you more freedom of movement and mobility and speech and thought and all of that than other places, and that you use them to the best of your ability, as opposed to the notion that you're being screwed. And each of them has a different idea about who's screwing you. Bannon's fantasy is that you could put them together, but you can't because the the Bannon wing of the right thinks that it's the left that's screwing them, and it's the Sanders people think it's the right that's screwing them, and how you then say, well, we can all make common cause against the middle, which isn't who they think is screwing them. I don't think you can put this genie back in the bottle. I mean, I don't know what we're going to do for the rest of our lives in relation to politics, but you can't sort of like trust is going to have to be earned again, right? But if your default position is distrust, someone says something and you think that they might be the first thing you think is that they're lying.
I think a lot of this is generational, though.
Well, that's bad then, because if it's generational, it's the younger generation. No,
no, what, no? Really?
The Bernie supporter isn't young.
Well, the Trump supporter isn't young.
Okay, then it's not generational. If I'm right that they are motivated by, if they come from the same kind of root with wildly different villains, then by definition, right, it's not generational.
No, I can't imagine that this generation of young socialists is going to be socialists for the rest of their life, unlike the other generations of young socialists.
You're saying you can't imagine that they will?
No, right. They will grow up like they always do.
Right.
Everybody grows up and becomes a homeowner.
That's a very... I love your optimism. I salute your passion. I think that...
2016, guys, was the revenge of the baby boomers. No offense, but that was not a generational election. That was the grievances of one baby boomer generation versus the grievances of another baby boomer generation, as you wrote quite effectively. The Sinatra generation versus the
first wave feminists. Right. Well, except I still think you look at the Bernie supporters and you say, if you're looking at the future of the Democratic Party, you're not looking at the Hillary baby boomers. You're looking at think about this again. Sanders raised $270 million in hard money. That's the famous $27 donation, right? $270 million he raised. He raised more than Hillary did in hard money. How is that possible? How did that happen? We don't know. We don't know what that's going to mean. We don't know if it's a one-off. You have to presume it's not really a one-off.
Probably not a one-off, because Ossoff was able to raise, what,
$30 million
for a House district, and it also doesn't matter.
But by the way,
they both lost.
Boomers didn't hate Sanders. Liberal boomers that thought he was great and important, but okay, now let's not have him mess up Hillary's chances.
Yeah, well, then they got mad at him because it was like this thing where Santorum, if you remember in 2012, like you remember, it's like, Santorum, get out of the race already.
Right.
All you're doing is hurting Romney.
Right.
You know, and it was true. He was hurting Romney.
Right.
You
know, they weren't offended by the message.
Yeah, they weren't offended by the message, except to the extent that it was like, oh, it's one white, another white guy trying to get the woman. You know, like that whole line. But I don't know. I'm just saying I wonder if we go to a larger point. So voice of the – you wrote this post last week. I'm surprised to hear you kind of disagreeing with your own premise about the listening to the Trump voter, right? And you started this by talking about how they've had enough. They're not leaving him, right? This week proved that. I don't know what the number is. Like Kristen Soltis Anderson puts the number 25%. That there is a 25% that will, you know, literally, if Trump shot someone on Fifth Avenue, that would be fine with them. And then some people think it's higher. Like maybe we're seeing it right now. Maybe it's 35%. Maybe it's not 25%.
But what am I disagreeing with myself on?
Because you're saying that the support is thin. And I'm saying I don't think that's thin. I mean, it's thin, like she could use 50% instead of 30%. We'd be better off with 50%.
No, I mean, I think that 25% is scary enough
to majority of Republicans that they're not going to turn on him. Well, Republican elected officials. I'm not talking now about Republican rank and file Republicans.
My instinct here is that quite a bit of that is rationalization, which is a lie to yourself. And that eventually you've come face to face with your own lie. Now, it's going to be really hard. You may never publicly admit it, but it's something you're telling yourself.
Okay, but you remember the line from The Big Chill, right?
I've never seen
it. Rationalization. Don't knock rationalizations. They're more important than sex. Because did you ever go a week without a rationalization?
Right, there are like three rationalizations.
It's like one of the great lines, Jeff Goldblum in The Big Chill. It's one of the enduring lines from a pretty factitious
movie. No, I think it's generally a weak force, but it's like gravity. I mean, if there's enough of it, it becomes something that's valuable.
And, you know, I mean, I don't know, maybe it's true. Maybe everybody, because it's was the 10,000th thing, everybody, even on the right, went excessively, maybe I went excessively ballistic. Maybe it's like, of course he didn't mean he liked the Nazis, you know. But it's like, well, you can't just go and go and go and go and go and then expect on the 97th time you say something stupid and offensive that we're not going to say, okay, enough already. Like, I understand you.
And there may be a breaking point. I mean, if you have we have Republican politicians who are very uncomfortable with this guy. And we keep forgetting that there's quite a bit of pressure on him from exogenous sources that will be building and aren't going away. There's an investigation into this guy's family that could bear fruit.
Right.
So I wouldn't go so far as to say that this is the dynamic that's going to persist.
By the way, there is no salvation. This is the one thing that I find a little odd. So if you take that argument, right, the Mueller is going to get is going to squeeze Trump world so tight that Trump will resign to save his family. Well, he can't save his family that way.
Right.
Mueller's squeezing his family and is like on the left. You know, it's not like he, by quitting the indictments and the everything like that, that the theoretical trouble will go away. They'll still get indicted. He's in better shape staying in the presidency and just pardoning everybody, you know, and then like facing the music for that, that he would be by quitting. Like, quitting doesn't get you out of the bind you're in. This train, if there's a bind, this train is, you know, going down a track.
See, I think that the shift we're talking about in politics actually goes beyond Trump and will therefore outlive him. We see it in this effort of everyone wanting to tar their political enemy with the very worst among them. So the effort on the left is to paint all conservatives as
Nazis,
alt-right Nazis, and the effort on the right is to paint all liberals violent Antifa.
Right.
And this has become a very important and dishonest practice on both sides now. It's sort of apart from Trump.
Yeah. And then, of course, you have the bizarre phenomenon on the left of the refusal to separate themselves from Antifa. I mean, that's the astonishing thing. So there are people in Boston throwing urine on cops. There were 27 arrests. You know, we saw a video of the horrible, nasty things happening in the streets. And if you brought it up, people were like, you're grasping at straws. That's not true. And you're blah, 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 right? All of that. And then on the right, though, of course, a lot of us were like, yeah, we better look deep into our souls because they're alt-right next and Nazis demonstrating and they come from somewhere and we're not going to separate ourselves. We can't, you know, we separate ourselves, but, you know, something's going on here. But you're not allowed to say that on the left. Like, in the left, that's like, that's incredibly unfair. And it is, and it's similarly unfair to say that we are the alt-right. But yeah, that's where we are. I think it's a little weirder to get into the problem for the right is that when you fall for the notion that being a conservative means that you have to be an out and out and open supporter of statuary dedicated to the sacrifices of people who tried to destroy the United States in the 1860s. That's where I draw the line. Like, I'm not going to stand here and say that all statues should be torn down and all of that, but you can't then also move me into I do think, like, the past is enduring. You don't erase it and all of that, but I'm not going to stand here and defend conservative Confederate statuary. Like, that's ridiculous.
I've known. Built in 1989.
Yeah, right, in Arizona. That's right. Yeah. So, but similarly, I think liberals need to be incredibly careful.
Put a, refine the point a little bit. I mean, what we saw in Durham with the tearing down of a statue by an outraged mob of young avowed socialists was legitimately terrifying. And what we've seen in Baltimore as a result,
where somebody took a sledgehammer today. Yeah.
To a monument to Christopher Columbus that was 200 years old, that kind of behavior is absolutely repulsive. Right. And legitimately terrifying to people who are afraid of the pace of change already.
Okay, see, this is interesting to me. The Columbus statue, and maybe we can sort of close on this. So the Columbus statue, right? The idea that the evil of the United States begins with the ship of Christopher Columbus, right? So this is now when we hit the 500th anniversary of 1492 and 1992. That was when all this started. You remember, there's nothing to celebrate about Columbus. Columbus
came. I was 10 years old.
You were 10, I know. It was disgusting. He came and he brought syphilis and it killed half the population of the subcontinent and you know, colonialism, and he didn't discover America. There were people living in the America. That's ridiculous. And Columbus is not a hero. He was a symbol of colonization and blah, 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 blah. And that was one of the earliest moments at which you started seeing this turn in American education over the 20 years of, or 30 years of sort of anti-colonial leftism kind of taking over the universities, that it had started to bear real fruit in the larger popular culture, that the move of Europe to the Americas was viewed as a bad and not a good. And if we come 25 years after that, literally 25 years after that too, we go from destroying Confederate statuary because people are outraged by it and they take it into their own hands to destroy Confederate statuary because the Confederacy was a force for destructiveness and evil. You then take it to Columbus. Then you are getting at the root of the American experiment 200, 300 years before the American experiment even began.
And Donald Trump says during these reviled press conferences, many of which should be, that look out, they're coming for Washington. They're coming for Jefferson, because there is no limiting principle on this idea that if you were a slaveholder in the antebellum South, that you should be wiped from history's reverence. You can be in a museum, right, but not in the public square. And guess what? This is treated like a neo-Confederate talking point. This has been the case that liberals have been advocating since 2015, at least, and earlier in the wake of the Charleston shooting. We had really significant debates about whether or not we should have things named for Lee and Jefferson. And the Jackson-Jefferson dinners started being erased from Democratic history. I mean, this is something that isn't bizarre. You have cable news contributors this week saying that these things need to happen. So it's not as though people are making this up. Trump supporters do have a grievance there.
Right. Well, that's my point. So there we get back to the question of whether or not the cultural dominance of the left is the reason that Trump will not fall below, 35% support in the United States, because we have a total matter antimatter reaction counter reaction system going here, and they overplay their hand every time. If not that there's a they here, there's no liberal dominant thing. It's that this is that the root of left liberalism is the idea that there is that America is at root a diseased country, and that it was born not only in original sin like everything else, but that original sin defines it, and that the original sin, it's not like there's a war between the good and bad parts, and the original sin is something that we're still, in Lincoln's second inaugural terms, that we're still suffering from, right? But it is what defines us. And if you don't believe that, it's going to be very hard to accept the left liberal attack on Trump. I don't mean like our attack on Trump, right? Our attack on Trump is, this is unseemly and disgusting, and you should be able to say that a Nazi is a Nazi, and that people who say that, the white race is being destroyed are basically disgusting and like that. I mean the notion that, you go from, but we stop there and say you should also learn something about your ABCs and go to school and learn history and all of that. And they're just saying destroy history because history, American history is bad and it should all be destroyed.
So I'm going to be Mr. Optimistic again because I don't know if this can, if this is a permanent feature of our existence. I'm reading Bruce Bauer's Victims of Revolution, and he defines how this really started with, you know, an intellectual trend in the 1970s and a variety of authors who were Marxists, you know, unashamed Marxists. And that's where this new version of American history comes from, and it's become this sort of vogue social justice, intersectionality, and that sort of thing, which has taken over the academic world and filtered into culture now, only in the last couple of years, as this phenomenon has matured. It's not as though this is a really like a permanent feature of American politics. It's maybe 35 years old. It's reaching late stage decay because it is dumbing itself down as it becomes a commercial product. And we right now we have a real revival of frustration with and fear of totalitarian socialist regimes being led by the left. The left is attacking North Korea and Venezuela and places that are otherwise they would be amenable to supporting five years ago.
North Korea, they wouldn't have been amenable to supporting.
There's quite a bit of leftist apologism for North Korea, for aggression. Okay.
You're saying it's a late stage decay. I'm saying it's only just getting started. That's the question. Like two generations of domination of these ideas at the highest education level filters down to education schools, filters down to high schools and grammar schools, filters down into the way everything is taught, filters down into the way everything is viewed, and we end up with a perspective on the world and life that people are bathed in without even knowing it, and that's partially where the ignorance of history comes in and the ignorance of the complications of history comes in. And the fact that nobody knows anything, nobody reads anything, and the only book they ever cite is Harry Potter. It's good that they read Harry Potter. Yeah, Harry Potter was fantastic. I love it. I'm in the middle of the fifth, reading my fifth book to my son, and he's 7 years old, and I hope that he reads more books than Harry Potter. But from what I can tell on Twitter, all any liberal ever has ever read is Harry Potter, because everything is analogized to Harry Potter.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think this is the beginning of the institutionalization of this stuff. I mean, I always think about...
Not the beginning. I think it's that's matured. Yeah.
No, but it's gone from.
They're all tenured.
That's my point.
They're all tenured. They've all been tenured.
But that's what I always think about, because I always think about Alan Bloom's book. I always think about The Closing of the American Mind, which was what, 80?
30 years ago.
Right? So
published 30 years ago.
He was writing primarily about the students. They're now the tenured professors.
Right.
That's purchase.
There's maybe 10% of them are the tenured professors.
Yeah.
The rest of them went off to write for blogs.
So they had
to dumb down the product in order to make it commercially accessible.
Or they're everybody else.
So now we're obsessing over faces on dollar bills and statuary and everything that resembles politics, but is not in fact actual politics.
Right.
That's the decay. That's where we create
just
a product.
I don't know. There was
a lot of
nonsense in the 1970s and the 1980s culturally, and it's not as though any of it slowed down the total takeover of the culture by the left. Like it was as ridiculous then as it is now in different ways, in different stress points and different stressors. And the same thing where like sensible people on the left are like, well, this isn't us. This is ridiculous. I mean, all this stuff is totally ridiculous. And then after 2 or 3 years, they buy into it because it becomes the dominating. Well, you can't. I mean, you're so you know. And someone says you're triggering me, and it's like, I don't mean to trigger you. I'm so sorry.
Well, it's also I've seen this thing where like boomer liberals get kind of radicalized by their college age kids now.
Oh yeah, there's a lot.
You know, like it pushes them.
Yeah.
Further, like it sort of gets them back in touch with and exacerbates their youthful leftist.
Look, Noah, I was once as optimistic as you because I was younger then, and I didn't want. But I just don't know that you could look at the present moment and think that there are grounds for optimism. You can think that there are grounds that there'll be a sort of sensible or prudent restructuring of things so that things don't like literally fall off into you know, that we don't live in a sewer for the rest of our existences and our political system completely collapses. But I think we're in a
fundamentally unserious time, and we are unserious people in an unserious time. And then when an actual existential disaster happens, as it inevitably will, we will sober up. That will be a better time. but it'll be a more sober time.
The problem with being fundamentally unserious is that then you can have an existential disaster and people won't sober up. They'll respond to it like unserious, silly, stupid people. Trump faces an existential disaster. Do you really think that he'll sober up and become you know, Harry Truman?
No, I do hope that the paradigm is shifted by the time the existential disaster happens.
I mean, people don't turn into something else, you know. Somebody said to me this weekend.
Sure, they do. We were an unserious people in 9/11. We rose to meet the threat.
Yeah, we rose to meet the threat, and then we ran away from the threat the minute that things got hot. Anyway, so with that, the crushing morosity returns to the commentary podcast. Even though I think there was a lot of energy there, a lot of energy and enthusiasm in our crushing. But Noah, to be fair, Noah is not crushingly morose. Yeah. But we'll get him there. We'll beat him into submission. I think. So thanks for joining us. For Abe Greenwald and Noah Rothman, I'm John Podhoretz. Keep the candle burning.